This podcast contains explicit material. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, and welcome to The Joy of Text, the podcast about Judaism and sexuality. We're coming to you live from Harvard Hillel. My name is Shira Eliassian. You might recognize my voice from Jofa Ads in The Joy of Text episodes. With me on tonight's podcast is Rabbi Dov Linzer, Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivat Chovei Torah, and Dr. Batsheva Marcus, President of Jofa and Clinical Director of Mays Women's Health. Tonight, we'll answer a listener question and then take questions from our live audience. Tonight's listener question is, my boyfriend and I love listening to your podcast. As a matter of fact, we almost feel like we know you. So we decided we would write to you and see what your opinion was on a problem we've been struggling with for the past year. We've been dating for 2 years and are planning on getting married as soon as he has finished with graduate school and we can live in the same place. We are physically intimate when we see each other, even though we don't have sex, and we don't plan to until we are married. Both of us feel pretty guilty and we've discussed the idea of my using the mikveh now. I'd probably only have to go once because I had an IUD put in. We are still not planning on having sex until marriage, but we thought it would fix any other halachic problems in the meantime.
Okay, that's what we do. We fix halachic problems. So what we love about listener questions, and you should feel free over the next couple months if you have your own questions to send them in, what we love about them is they tend to shed light on a broader question than the specific question that the listener thinks that they're asking. And so this question was a beautiful example of that. So obviously one of the core pieces is the issue of using the mikveh before you're married, and that really will be what we'll be focusing on. But a bunch of other things kind of came up along the way, and we thought we'd spend just a few minutes discussing those first. So the IUD came up here. This woman said, I'd only have to use the mikveh once because I have an IUD put in. It's a method of contraception. It's a little plastic T-like contraption that gets inserted into the uterus. And what happens is, depending on what kind of IUD you have, it may make your period weaker and weaker until it disappears entirely. So that is why this particular woman thinks she should probably only have to use the mikveh once, because then she probably wouldn't be getting her period again. So before we move on to the kind of other pieces of it, anything halachic you want to say about the IUD?
I think the only really relevant issue about the IUD is to be aware that it's certainly seen as halachically as an acceptable form of birth control.
So that was issue number one. The other thing came up is something that I talk about all the time, so you're probably sick of hearing me talk about this, but she keeps using sex and intercourse synonymously, right? The writer, she talks about we've been intimate with each other, we're physically intimate when we see each other, but we don't have sex. So anybody who's heard this podcast before knows how much this drives me insane, okay? So there's lots of ways of having sex, and intercourse is one way of having sex, and it just, there's so many problems with using those two words synonymously.
Maybe you should define those terms for people that haven't heard you say it before.
Okay, so define this. When I say somebody's having sex, I am talking about a couple being involved, one person by themselves or a couple being involved in an activity which is sexual and generally is least attempting to lead to orgasm, even if it hasn't led to orgasm. Again, for one person or many people or two people, hopefully not more people than that. Certainly colloquially in society, when people say sex, they often mean vaginal penetration intercourse. Certainly halachically, when people talk about sex, they mean vaginal penetration and intercourse. And I feel like setting up that dichotomy is really important, because when you lump them together, you end up with all kinds of problems. You get married and then all you're having is intercourse and that's supposed to be fabulous and that's all you're doing. Or there's going to be times in your life when you can't have intercourse for any number of reasons, but that doesn't mean you have to stop having sex. There's a lot of other ways to have sex. And you're going to be having sex, please God, for many, many, many years in your life. And so the sex has to be much broader.
Yeah, and this actually transitions to the halachic, to the issue about the mikveh. All of the prohibitions in the Torah against, let's sort of call it gilui arayot, which is forbidden sexual acts, refer to intercourse. The rabbis define that the act of when the Torah forbids sexual acts, it means intercourse, which is either the penis in the vagina or in the anus. So that's the halachic definition. It does not require ejaculation. And anything that's short of that is not in the strict biblical prohibitions against these acts, whether they're about a woman being a nida, whether it's a case of adultery, whether it's a case of incest, whatever the sort of prohibition might be that we're talking about. The debate comes around, well, what about all those other acts that are sex but not intercourse? Are those seen as only rabbinic prohibitions? Are there also biblical prohibitions, but of a lesser severity? And here there's a debate. Rambam Maimonides understands that sex that is not intercourse is still biblically forbidden, not with the same weight, but it's still broadly included in the prohibition. And Ramban Nachmanides understands that it's only of the level of a rabbinic prohibition. There are some, I'll just mention, that want to interpret Rambam very broadly and say any form of sexual contact, even kissing or something like that, would be included. But there's very strong evidence that Rambam, when he says that there is something that's biblical, is talking about something that's much closer to actual intercourse. So I think something that Batsheva would call sex, but not intercourse. So that's actually the question about what weight those restrictions have when we're not dealing with intercourse. So in this case with this woman, she's actually saying that she's not having intercourse with her boyfriend. So the prohibition, you know, the sort of halachic problem in what they're currently doing with her not going to the mikvah is something that is possibly of a rabbinic violation, possibly of a biblical one, but it's certainly not the most severe of the violations.
So let me go back to the crux of the question. We're still not planning on having sex, intercourse, until marriage, but we thought it would fix any other halachic problems in the meantime for me to go to the mikvah.
Right. So the halachic problems that they're referring to is sex, sexual activity, but non-intercourse, either as a rabbinic or a lighter biblical violation when the woman is a nida. So the question is actually often asked, maybe not in public, but more and more rabbis are getting these questions about a woman who, or a man, but a woman and a man who are in a relationship, and they actually are having intercourse, and they're in a stable relationship. And the question is it better that she goes to the mikvah so that they don't violate the weighty biblical prohibition of intercourse when the woman is a nida, which is, you know, isur karet, considered to be like punishable by divine excision? As not to transgress that, is it better to go to the mikvah? On the other hand, idea of going to the mikvah before you're married seems to have very consequential societal sort of implications. Because is it sending a message that people can have sex before marriage as long as they're going to the mikvah? And I think that's like raises like really big questions about weighing broader societal values and deep religious values as opposed to sort of what I call technical halachic weight. And I will say that I definitely know that there are a lot of rabbis that are posketing to people on a private and an individual one-on-one basis, that they are saying, you absolutely, if you're already having intercourse, they say sex, but they mean intercourse, if you're already having intercourse, then of course it is better to go to the mikvah and not have this serious violation rather than to not go to the mikvah. But they make it very clear that this is a private ruling, because as soon as they were to get, if they were to get up and say, okay, anybody in the community that happens to be in a relationship, I want you to know you should all be going to the mikvah, then what they're doing is at the communal level, they're basically saying, like, it's okay, we can have premarital sex as long as you do this. And that clearly is something that nobody wants to be saying.
I feel like we need to sort of stratify a little bit, right? So the first question could be, why not have every girl from the time she starts menstruating go to the mikvah?
Right.
Then you don't have to worry about anybody having any problems, right? That would be the most makil or machmir, depending on how you're looking at it, perspective, right? Then you could say anybody getting into any kind of relationship maybe should go to the mikvah, because then you don't have to worry about even things like holding hands or kissing.
Right.
Then you get into the, like, we're actually having sexual activity. What about them? And what about intercourse? Like, I feel like those are very different phases.
Right.
And we're struggling as a community, I think, with a very different norm than we were, I know, 100 years ago. So
right. So actually, I was doing that, except I was doing the reverse order. I mean, I was saying that, you know, the case that would most warrant say, go to the mikveh is the case where they're already engaged in activity, which is a clear, weighty biblical violation. And even there, so there you definitely have rabbis that are telling people on a private basis, of course, you should go to the mikveh, but they don't want to be making any public announcements, even though they could be saying, well, if I make a public announcement, then all the people who aren't asking me will know, and I'll save all of them from sinning.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, but the cost is that it basically sends a message that there's not a problem with, you know, that we don't care about premarital sex. And what I was saying was that we do care about it for two reasons. One is, for some, again, this really is a halachic violation, not a nida violation, but a different type of a violation. That's debated. Not all agree to that. But on the other hand, you know, there's like, this is like a deep religious value that is not maybe fully expressed in formal halachic terms, but I'll just give you some examples where we see this. You know, in the Talmud, clearly the Talmud's assumption is that marriage precedes sex. The woman is assumed to be a besula, a virgin. If she's not a virgin going into the marriage, that's clearly, you know, a major concern. There's a position in the Talmud that if a single man and single woman have sex before marriage, that renders the woman a zona. You know, this not necessarily prostitute, but maybe the word's nut, like a fornication, which would make her not able to marry a kohen. Just the very word nut means, you know, to fornicate, means like sex outside of marriage. You know, there's these like deep, like religious concerns around this, which aren't always fully articulated in halachic terms.
When a rabbi is presented this issue of a couple that's having intercourse,
right.
Is that where
you're talking about? That's what I'm talking about, yes. So if the couple's already having intercourse, so they're already in this most weighty halacha category, there are definitely many rabbis that will say yes. In private, they'll tell them use the mikvah. There are many mikvahs that will ask questions. There are mikvahs that, as a policy, do not ask questions. The Upper West Side mikvah, by the way, I know it's about 200 miles from here. Anyway, I think it has a policy to not ask any questions about whether, you know, the woman's marital status. But though even they are not making any public statements because they think that public statements will really go against this deep value that we hold as a community, which is to wait until marriage, until we actually have intercourse. So it raises more challenging questions in this case, because in this case, and, you know, I'll just share that I feel conflicted. You know, on the one hand, going to the mikveh can address the halachic problematics of this case, but they're not having intercourse, and it might really not be worth it in the trade-off, because maybe it is sending a signal that, like, I would say two things. Number one is, like, what might be the broader implications for this couple and for the community, you know? Does word get out? Does word not get out around these types of issues? And the other issue, though, I would say, is that I fear that for a lot of people that grow up with a deep internalization of halacha, they let halacha do the work for them, and they don't themselves determine their own values and their own lines and their own, like, limits. So as soon as you go to the mikveh, then it's like, how good are you going to be at, you know, keeping a line in a particular place and saying, okay, we're only doing this and we're not doing that. Oh, once there's no halachic problem, why shouldn't we be having intercourse and so on? So I'm not saying everybody is like that, but I definitely know many people who don't have enough of their own moral compass or their own sense of boundaries when halacha isn't creating those boundaries for them. So in a case like this, I actually am more conflicted what the sort of proper advice would be in this case.
I mean, I don't have anything to add from the halachic end. I only have a very practical approach, which is that when a young woman comes to me and says to me that she's decided she's not married and she wants to use the mikveh, then I say a few things. One is, make sure you're prepared. Either you go to a mikveh that is okay with unmarried people coming, or make sure that you have somebody give you directions. Because going to the mikveh is, and I have a young woman I know who did this. She just sort of blithely walked into a mikveh, and the mikveh attendant said to her, bath or shower, which is always the first question they ask you when you come into the mikveh. And she was like, what? And so then it became very clear very quickly to the mikveh lady. She said, are you a bride? And then, of course, it just went downhill from there. And it was a horrible experience. So I always say, you know, make sure that you go in knowing, looking like you know what you're doing. So talk to, seriously, I'm not kidding. Like, yeah. Seriously, like, talk to somebody, have somebody walk you through exactly what's going to happen, or go to a lake or a, you know, the ocean, or do something where there's little less going to be a little less inspection of how you're doing it. So it's a complicated issue, and I feel like it's something people have to be prepared for.
Right. I want to add that in terms of this issue about setting boundaries, it's something that we grapple with as a community. Like, this goes on a lot, various forms of sex, sexual touch, sexual contact with, yes, intercourse, not intercourse. We sort of pretend it doesn't happen, and, you know, we don't give people any good sense of how to sort of make decisions around these issues, which is something that we've spoken about before. But as I said, personally, I don't know, personally, I'm sort of more, as a, in my role as rabbi, I'm sort of more concerned about the broader societal implications. So I think that it's only when the sort of situation is more halachically severe am I sort of more pushed to respond in a certain way. So
didn't you say there was a tshuva out there about you better
yeah, so that's actually all right, that's actually what I brought here just to prove in case anybody doesn't believe me. This is a Shelo Tshuva Asher Chanan. It's by a Haredi Svardi Posek, Hanan Aflalo, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, and he was asked basically two similar questions about a woman who was in a stable relationship, and she was having sex and with her boyfriend, with her partner, and intercourse, and the question was, should go to the mikveh or not go to the mikveh? So he said, of course you go to the mikveh. But again, he repeated, we say this in private, we don't say this in public. He actually goes one step further and says, and she should make a bracha when she goes to the tefillah, because, you know, he says, why not? It's accomplishing the same halachic thing. So when you go to the mikveh, make a bracha on going to the mikveh, like a married woman does.
Why would anybody argue you shouldn't make a bracha when you go to the mikveh?
Well, okay, so there's a halachic argument, and what I would sort of say a policy argument, and I feel stronger here about the policy argument. The halachic argument would be that since, you know, classically mikvah, going to the mikvah has always been in the context, well, there was a time when it had nothing to do, when it wasn't specifically about sex. It was about when we lived in a world where there was sacrifices and holy, and truma and other types of holy objects, so people had to not be impure for other reasons. But in the post the temple sort of reality, it took place in the context of marriage. So we don't know that the rabbis ever established a bracha for it in a different context, even though halachically it accomplishes the same thing. For me, it's more of a policy issue. As soon as you make a bracha on it, you're not just sort of saying this is a compromise, it's the lesser of two evils, it's the better choice given your situation. You're actually sort of like fully validating and even sanctifying what's happening right now, meaning not just the going to the mikveh, but the whole arrangement. So I sort of feel that is like a terrible religious message, because that exactly cuts under this point about really that, you know, sex should take place in marriage and not outside of marriage.
If a woman who is married goes to the mikveh and doesn't make a bracha,
yes, it's good. It counts. It works. You don't need a bracha pretty much for anything. You don't need a bracha for the mitzvah act to work. Okay, so that's a separate thing. But I will say that the absence or presence of a bracha sends a powerful message whether we think what we're doing is a religious act. So I think the making a bracha and turning this into like a sanctified religious act, not just a way of solving a halachic restriction, I think it sort of sanctifies the arrangement, which I think is like a major problem. So I would certainly say not to make a bracha.
Okay, you got sidetracked because you were going to tell
the other one was a similar, well, I'll just say because it's just so shocking. So this was a question about a woman also, but it was the man asking the question. And he was in this relationship, and he wasn't frum, but he was getting maybe a little bit more frum. And he said to the rabbi, I'm living with this woman. I understand there's this problem of nida, like he was getting frum. He says, I need some release. So what's better? Is it better that I masturbate or better that this woman goes to the mikvah and that we actually have intercourse? So the rabbi, because he is coming from such a almost Haredi perspective that sees masturbation as so serious of a sin, he says, well, of course it's better to have intercourse if the woman went to the mikvah than to masturbate. So
it's really counter to most, I think what most people would tell you now.
Yes, exactly. So it's interesting how people do certain types of halachic calculations. So I think we really have to think about, you know, what happens when those two things, the sort of our deep values around this issue, the societal issues and the halachic issues, don't exactly align. And to some degree, some of this is dealt with by sort of private counseling, but not sort of public pronouncements.
So I guess we're going to leave our poor question asker with the solid advice of, you've heard everything we had to say on the subject, now you got to make up your own mind.
Next up, we answer questions from our live audience, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Yeshivat Chovevei Torah is proud of its new class of 12 rabbis, which brings our total to 120 rabbis now serving Jewish communities. These modern Orthodox rabbis are making a difference in the United States, Europe, Australia, and Israel. If you think you have what it takes to be a Jewish leader and to be the next Chovevei Torah rabbi, come visit us and see what we're all about. For source sheets to accompany the Joy of Text episodes and for other great Torah, visit our Torah library at www.yctorah.org.
Okay, we're going to move to some of the questions that we've gotten collected and some of the questions we got beforehand, but we have the mic sitting there. So if anybody's brave enough to get up and say something, we're happy to hear that. We're going to have a moment of silence while everybody awkwardly decides whether they're... Does anybody have any thoughts?
So what bothered me about that first...
Pull it down a little.
Yeah.
What bothered me about that first question was the woman who asked the question said she had an IUD, but she also said that she wasn't planning to have intercourse before marriage. So why would she need an IUD? And that question kept on popping in my head the whole time.
Right. Somebody's jumping up and down saying, I know. Were you saying anything? The person who just answered was not at the mic. What she was saying was that there's many reasons women would choose to use birth control, and very often that might be of skin conditions, regulating their period, and IUD may be used for regulating their period, fear of being raped. I mean, that's pretty extreme.
I think it could also be as simple as if you really don't, like if cramps are very painful for you and having your period can sometimes be an inconvenience that you don't want to have to deal with on a monthly basis.
So that may answer the question. But it was interesting and a good question. I'm getting some snaps here from the audience. Okay. Let me focus on another question, which is a little less positive. We get some negative mail, as you can imagine. So one of the questions that was submitted, and it's similar to another question we got handed us tonight, is how do you feel about the very fact that you were discussing what is considered the most intimate part of Jewish life? Do you not feel this is blatant abuse of a forum to talk about what is held to be so personal to people? So that's a question that came in advance. I'm so glad that person asked the question because I love that question. I don't think so, and I'm going to tell you why. And then a question tonight we got, how is airing these opinions going to the mikvah, not discussing it publicly? Okay?
Right.
So very similar questions, and I'll give you my response, and I'm sure Dov has his own, but I see, and I get to interact every day of my life with the people who have fallen on the problems that have occurred because nobody has discussed these issues about sex, and even though we live in a society that is just drenched with sexual imagery, and there's just sex going on everywhere you look in TVs and movies and billboards, nobody has real conversations about sex. And I experience every day the pain and the anguish that this causes my patients, the misinformation they have, the dilemmas they get stuck in that they have nobody to discuss them with, misunderstandings of halachic positions that really wreak havoc with their sex lives. And I feel like it is not only an honor and a privilege, but like a chiyuv almost, to be discussing these things in a generic sense so that people can get answers to their questions. And I hear all the time about people like in even more Haredi communities where there's even less conversation, when they can listen to a podcast privately in their own home and they can get information and they can sort of see the different directions where an issue can be discussed and have their questions answered, that it has just been life-changing for people and life-saving for people. And I feel like there's nothing non-sanua about talking about these things when we're talking about them in the abstract and not talking about them about any particular individual. And so I feel really strongly that this has been one of the most important projects I've ever been involved with and I think has done the most good. Because in my practice, I can help one or two people, but I feel like this podcast has been a lifeboat for so many people who aren't in a position to get help on a one-on-one basis.
Wow. I'm not sure what I can add to that. I mean, I've had very similar experiences. Maybe I'll start by saying that, I think the story in the Gemara where Rav Kahana hides under the bed of Rav in order to find out how Rav is intimate and has sex with his wife, because he feels that that's part of learning how, you know, you're supposed to be with another person. And if Judaism and Halacha is supposed to govern our relationships, then they also govern even the most intimate aspects. And then anyway, he's under Rav's bed, and then he blurts something out when he's shocked at how Rav is acting, and Rav realizes he's under the bed, and Rav says, Rav Kahana, what are you doing here? And he says, Torah hi ulalamda nitzarech. This is Torah, and I have to learn it. And Rav's only response is, well, maybe, but not under my bed, you're not. So, not exactly in those words. But anyway, and that's really what I feel about this. I feel like we tend not to talk about these things publicly because they are private and intimate, but often because they relate to sex, the idea of being sort of private about these issues can easily translate as being ashamed about them. And a lot of people are going around with a lot of guilt and a lot of shame. And I think one of the things that this contributes to is it allows things to be discussed in the right context and in a healthy way. And it's done an enormous amount of good. The question we got tonight was a little different. And I want to tell you that I was also conflicted about that, because the question we got tonight on this index card was not, why is this whole enterprise acceptable? The question was, but one minute, you said, you know, rabbis give personal rulings to individual, case by case, to women about this, but they don't go ahead and make public proclamations. So aren't we, by saying that, isn't that making a public proclamation? And I have to tell you, you know, I was conflicted about that exact question.
Answer.
Well, first of all, I didn't say. I laid out the facts about how different people have dealt with it. But even beyond that, I took pains to position things with really making it clear what the different type, you know, that it's not a simple answer, that there's a lot that sort of in terms of what is sort of weighing on both sides of the equation here. And because of what I said before, because it's always a challenging, like a juggling act or high wire act to figure out how do you raise these things enough so that people who need to know and have access to that information and know that there is somebody that will give them an answer and a possibility and somebody that they can turn to. And at the other hand, not say things that people say, oh, well, I heard that you were talking about this. This means everything is allowed. I don't think we're ever going to fully solve that, but I think there's enough people that are not talking about it at all. And I think that we have to start tipping the balance in the other direction.
So I'm going to just add to that, because I feel like one of the things that we've tried really hard to strive for when we do this podcast is not to give black and white answers to things, but rather to lay out the issues and allow people to then make the best judgment for themselves. And I know that's a little bit, you know, verboten sometimes in the Orthodox community. Like, there's parts of the Orthodox community that feel like you go to a Rav, the Rav gives you an answer, and that you have to live by that answer no matter what. I guess I ascribe much more to the concept of the Rav as a teacher who sort of teaches you what the elements are that you need to be taking into consideration when you're making a decision, and in the end, forcing you to be a responsible adult in the Orthodox community to make your own decision about, given the halachic parameters, what that decision will look like.
Next up, more audience questions, but first, a word from our sponsors.
At Mays Health, we know that if you're having sexual problems, it can have a significant impact on your life and on your relationship. We also know that these problems are not all in your head, and it's important for you to know that pain, low libido, erection, or orgasm problems can all be successfully resolved. Mays is the only treatment center of its kind in the area, addressing both the physical and emotional sources of sexual difficulties. If you're a man or a woman experiencing sexual problems, please don't go another day feeling like there is no solution. Visit us at www.mayshealth.com.
I want to deal with one or two questions here that were actually direct, feedback or responding to what we discussed earlier. One is, you talked about the premarital versus marital sex. Does any of this change if there's a formal plegish arrangement in place since the woman has been an aguna and refuses halachic marriage? So the parentheses really is a different point. Yeah, I want to say something about this. The discussion about whether, if the woman is not an Ida, is there a prohibition against premarital sex? And the argument that there is not because of the institution of Pilegish, concubine, which seems to be present in Tanakh, that seems to be a case of non-marriage, of a stable relationship. So it seems like it might be possible that it would be not a violation if the woman is not an Ida. So there, but others say that actually it is a violation and that sex, if it's not in the context of marriage, is clearly a violation, let's say, of the mitzvah of getting married or maybe some other mitzvah. So that's also a debate, Rambam and others. Often when I hear this discussed, people say, oh, it's mutter, it's permissible if the woman is a pilegesh, so we should reinstitute the institution of pilegesh, of concubine. And, you know, to me, this is like anybody who, wants their credentials as a feminist, like, I don't want to hear talk about a concubine. To me, that is such a sexist institution. It's basically women available as sex objects for men. At least that's the way I understand the institution of concubinage. And the point is that there's not a halachic status of a pilegesh. It's used as evidence. And I really think that it's not how we should be talking about this question, because I think it's demeaning to women. But what I do want to say is that this issue about, that was in parentheses, if the woman has been in agun and refuses halachic marriage, that's a different point. This is a woman who is still halachically married, if I understand this correctly. Like, if the woman's still halachically married, then it's not the question of extra or premarital sex. It's a married woman having sex with another man. I don't care about if it is a pilegesh or not a pilegesh context. That would still obviously be the violation of adultery, which is just why we really have to solve the aguna problem, but that's another discussion.
I think we should do that in the next 30 seconds. What do you think?
Exactly. That was my question. She's no longer an aguna, but she's been an aguna twice. She has three different gittin because apparently one of them didn't work. Oh, so it's, there is no...
So she's looking to do this because she does
she
not
She already has an
into...
annual annually renewing contract with her partner. They review it every
contract.
Year that they have a variety of different
right.
concerns written into that. It's not...
Oh, I see. So there definitely are women that because of the aguna issue, and not even when they've experienced it personally, I feel terrible for this woman, who are opting to not do halachic marriage. Some are doing marriage kiddushin on tnai, some are doing not halachic marriage, and, you know, creating a formal pilegish type of a contract, I think, is helpful in terms of sort of saying this is a serious, committed, real relationship. We're not just choosing today and can change our mind tomorrow. My point was more that I don't think halachically that's necessary, but I certainly understand where that's coming from.
Let me read this question. Are you ever going to address the issue of women's masturbation? The cultural expectations that women do not masturbate is, if anything, even more onerous than the ones imposed on men, not to mention the fact of a lack of education. I have been given to understand that the halachic restrictions are lower, but you wouldn't know it from the way people act. So we were a little struck by this question because we did a whole episode on female masturbation. It was called the female masturbation episode. But do you want to give a 30-second response to that?
One-sentence response is that the Gemara really focuses on male masturbation, primarily because the concern of the Gemara primarily is about spilling of semen, spilling of seed. Rav Moshe Feinstein sort of says there's two problems with masturbation. One is that it leads to ejaculation, which is not an issue for women, but he says the other problem is that it incites the evil desire upon oneself, meaning, you know, it provokes a person to sin. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says that would be a problem for women, but only if it were something that was sort of not just sort of sexual fantasy leading to sexual pleasure, but something that really was about planning to do a particular sexual violation. So Rav Moshe really says, and other poskim say as well, that there really is not a serious concern with female masturbation. Male masturbation is also a different episode and different areas of concern.
Yes. So you talked about how rabbis don't want to make general comments about women going to the mikveh before marriage because they don't want to change the boundaries of what's acceptable. So I guess I'm struggling with the fact that in doing so, it's sort of withholding certain autonomy that women have, right, or women should have, and preventing halakhic knowledge that they should be able to have as a result.
Right.
I think this is part of a much bigger question. In general, often halacha is treated that way, right? People aren't, this is not a unique question to this particular area. That is, that gets back to what I was saying before about people feeling like they go to the rabbi, they say to the rabbi, can I do X, Y, and Z? The rabbi comes down with a pronouncement saying, yes, you can, no, you can't. Halacha says yes, halacha says no, as opposed to giving the person kind of the background in order to make the best decision possible by saying, this is this level of Esor, this is this level of Esor, here are the conflicting values that we have, and here's where normative halacha comes out, or here there may be minority opinions that say this, and then allowing people to make their decisions. We always live in that tension, I think. That's not unique about sexual issues. The thing that makes it unique about sexual issues is that people are usually loath to ask the question. So, you know, I come from obviously a little bit of a more liberal stance on this issue. I'm sure that Dov is going to come in with a different kind of assumption, but no. That would be my first reaction.
Well, no, I agree with that, and so I want to clarify what I was saying. I was not saying that because of that concern, I would like say, oh, so I can't say X, Y, Z. I was saying that we have to be aware that that is a distinct possibility, but you're absolutely right. I want to empower people, but there also is a reality that some people, you know, don't do well in that. I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, somebody once came to me for a question, and when people come to me, you know, I'll say, well, you know, there's this opinion, and it depends, or whatever, and the answer is like, Rabbi, just tell me what to do. You know, and I think like a lot of people, now maybe not in this area, the more it's personal, whatever, right? I get that. But a lot of people are like, Rabbi, just tell me what to do. Like, I don't want to be making this decision, or maybe I'm not even able to guide myself in this area. So, that's why all of the conversation here has been very broad stroke general. Somebody comes to me with a particular issue. I want to understand them. I want to understand what's going on with their relationship. I want to understand how they're thinking about how they're going to manage their relationship based on the types of decisions that they make. But I'm fully with you that I think we should be, you know, sharing information and not withholding it. But we have to be honest about how, you know, about also the facts on the ground.
This is a question for Rabbi Linzer.
Yeah.
The previous semester, I was in a class on international law. And one of the big critiques that feminists usually bring is that for hundreds and hundreds of years, law has only been presented by men and interpreted by men. And you know, I find this very problematic when it comes to issues like NIDA, where you have men usually writing psak on issues that they never experience.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is kind of, you know, how can we address this in this day and age in our halachic discourse?
Well, I fully agree. And about, I don't know, a year ago or so, I wrote an article for the Jofa magazine about women post-GOAT and made it, you know, not exactly that point, but the point about how, you know, what does it mean that when halacha does not have the voice and the 50% of the population and their experiences as informing the halachic process. And I've made the point multiple times on the podcast that the Gemara is written by men, for men, you know, and it really does exclude the woman as subject and the woman as a voice in the halachic process. And thank God, you know, nowadays we have Yoatzot Halacha, and many of them are taking larger roles as actually, you know, independent halachic voices. And we have women who are going to Yeshivat Maharat and are becoming rabbinic leaders and involved in the halachic process. And I think that that's absolutely necessary.
I have to give a little shout out for those women who don't necessarily have titles like Maharat and or Yoatzot Halacha. More and more and more women are really learning these days. So anybody who has the necessary knowledge, anybody who knows the material and can forward that material to whoever's asking the question should be entitled to do so. And I think you're going to see more sensitivity. I would hope over the next generation or two that we will start to see a different level of sensitivity. So thank you for that question.
Next up, the final word. But first, a word from our sponsors. Hi everyone, it's Shira from Jofa, and I'm here to talk to you about our blog now being hosted by the Jewish Week. Jofa's blog is a place for you to voice your thoughts on anything and everything related to Jewish feminism, from feminist readings of this week's Parsha to what it's like to date as a Jewish feminist. The possibilities are endless, as long as you remain within our 1,000-word word limit. If you're interested in writing, contact me, Shira, at shira@jofa.org. I mean it. Contact me today, like right now, pause this episode and send me an email. I'll be waiting. Are we ready for the final word?
We are. Tonight's final word is coitus interruptus. You don't hear it very often because usually people nowadays call it pulling out. pulling out method. The idea is that the man pulls the penis out before he ejaculates. People do use it as a method of birth control. It is not a particularly effective method of birth control. It's not a bad method of birth control if you're using it in addition to either the Rhythm method or you're also using spermicide. That is what that term means, and I'm going to now turn it over to you.
Would you say why it's not effective?
Because often, for the number of reasons why it's not effective, sometimes you actually don't pull out when you think you're going to be pulling out, or sometimes men can leak ejaculate before they actually ejaculate entirely, and so there could be millions of sperm heading in there, even unintentionally and not and unknowingly.
So interestingly, there is a term in the Gemara for this, because this apparently was a common form of birth control before there was more effective forms of birth control. And the term in the Gemara is very colorful. It's dash mi bifnim vizore mi bachutz, which is threshes on the inside and winnows on the outside. So if anybody knows how one gets grain out of wheat, you have cows sort of stomp on it with like a platform that has spikes, and that sort of separates the seeds from the husks, and then you throw it up and the husks flow, and the sort of seeds flow down and the husks flow away, and that's called winnowing. So it's very colorful because obviously you have the seed and the semen here, and you're sort of loosening it, and then you're sort of spraying it. So that's the sort of illustration in the Talmud, it actually understands that this was, it's first of all, it's discussed halachically in terms of questions about zera levatala, spilling of seed, wasting of seed. Is this an acceptable form of birth control or not? And it also identifies it with the sin of Aaron Onan, because in the Torah, where we get the word onanism, although that was not masturbation, the Torah says that when he would come unto his brother's wife, he would waste the seed to the ground. And the Talmud describes this. It says, dash mi bifnim vizora mi bachutz, which exactly was this act of coitus interruptus as a way in which he was having intercourse without having to possibly impregnate or thinking that it was not going to lead to that. We never found out because he died too soon anyway.
Thank you so much. And okay. Thank you to all of you for being such an incredible audience. Thank you to the students of Harvard and the Cambridge community for joining us for this live recording. This episode was recorded by Mike Hurst and edited by Rebecca Honig-Friedman. If you have questions for The Joy of Text, you can submit them anonymously online at www.thejoyoftext.org. You can listen to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or with any podcast app. I'm Shira Eliassian. Thank you so much for listening.